Hello guys, welcome back to another episode of Musings of a Tired Nigerian Girl. Let's get into it. Hello guys, welcome back to another episode of Musings of a Tired Nigerian Girl. Welcome. This is my first episode post New Year. And I'm going to try not to do an introduction to the podcast in this episode because technically this episode is a book club episode. I know that I may or may not have told you guys in the past that we're not doing book club anymore because that book just bored me to death. But actually, no, it didn't bore me to death, it just became a chore to read, especially read out loud. But I'm here again because my mama, you know, that woman ain't raised no quitter. So I'm back here and I'm going to try and finish this book. The thing is, I really want to do a lot of book content and movie content this year because I just feel like that's just who I am, and I want to become like, I want to stay true to myself. I have a lot of things to talk to you guys about, books and movies, so we're going to be doing that. And honestly, it just made so much sense that for me to explore other book options, I should at least finish this book. This is a book that for some reason I never finished in real life, so the least I can do is finish it on the podcast. You know, let me have some shame because of you guys and finish this book on the podcast. This is a long book. Oh my god, it's like 1889 pages and we're just on page 847. Okay, 848. This took us a long time. Honestly, I just got tired of reading it. I'm not even going to lie. It seemed as if the chapters were not finishing and I'll be talking for long. Because tell me why I'm reciting a book for an hour of book club. I'm just at the point it just becomes, oh, I just need to take a break. But all that to say, I really like the book. The book is quite interesting. Me personally, I still haven't hacked the power of reading this book not within godly hours. I don't read this book at night just because I feel like me and them spirits be reading this book together after my grip. So Ben Okri, no thank you. The book is just something that I don't read at night. It just scares me a bit. My sister, however, my junior sister, she really likes the book. To her, it's like funny and hilarious. She's probably, what I'm talking about is like all the spirits and how they look and everything. She's probably thinking, they look like cartoon characters to her, which is not at all what me I'm imagining. And talking about Ben and Chris Famish Road, I feel like me being a Muslim, it really like makes me, another thing makes me really scared. Somehow, not really scared, but like a bit like, ugh, I'd rather not read it sometime. It's because like as a Muslim, I believe in jinns and whatnot. And you know that this type of thing is real. I forget about being a Muslim. As an African person, if it was a white girl reading this book, she probably would be afraid. She would be like, okay, what's all this weird looking, spirit looking things that they talk about? But as an African person, you know for a fact that those things be happening. So that's another reason why it just makes me, it's like surreal for me. Trust me, I can read a vampire book at night. That is a joke to me. Like the only thing that ever made like all these supernatural creatures a bit scary for me was when I watched Supernatural. Pre-me watching Supernatural, the series, Sam and Dean, you know. Pre-me watching Supernatural, honestly, it was a joke. But Simpson Valentine. Twilight was a joke. Are you serious? And the thing is, I read all the books, but that got me all the books of Twilight. So I read them even up to today. Sometimes I crave to read them, but honestly, I can't be bothered to go and hunt them where they are. But all that to say, like, I can read vampire books, witches books, things like that. I find them even interesting at any time. But you won't catch me reading an African literature about some spirits in the night because I know they are real. The witches and spirits and wizards and jinns be happening in real life. So I'm not about to gas up myself into having a bad dream. So that's why I don't really like really pass my dream for me personally. I tried it one time and I could barely sleep. And then in the middle of the night took lights. Oh my god. Oh my days. So yeah, that's that about that. Anyways, we are back to reading The Famished Road. So in the beginning part of, I don't say the beginning of this particular episode, I want to talk about the main book for me. Apart from the fact that it's really long, I feel like it's easy to read. However, there are some words that you can even hear me struggling with them because I'm like, what do you mean? Libations and them, etc. So yeah, apart from that little like sprinkle of some things, I feel like it's quite easy read. But another thing I'd say is Benoff's use of imagery and personification in this book is really intense and really like it makes it really awesome. There's something about this genre that I particularly like. You know, it's like real African, like it's the realest African literature you can read. Just pays an ode to our own personal, like our own African, like mythical creatures and whatnot, the spirits and whatnot. I just feel like Azaro is a child that doesn't hear what. I'm not going to lie to you. That boy don't be hearing what at all, please, at all. Like in this chapter that I'm about to read, why did you do that? I want to just ask him, why did you do that? There was no reason at all. And even if you suspected, I feel like a normal human being would have, even if they suspected that, okay, there are places where they'd be working and have some spirits. The normal human being thing to do is not to go back there. But this boy stay going back, stay interacting with the spirits, stay eating the food of the woman that conjure up the spirits. Are you for real, young boy? Are you for real? So that is the reason why, like, you know, it's that boy. And then his dad is a character. His dad is a character. Let me tell you my favorite people in this book. First of all, the photographer. The photographer knows that anybody. This man snapped in the middle of pandemic. They were having some cholera and dysentery, and this man, even though upon regardless upon still that he had cholera and dysentery, tell me why this nigga was there snapping pictures. Even the time in the beginning where they came to pick up Azaro's dad and fight and everything, and they destroyed the place and whatnot. Tell me why this man is in the corner with the camera. And the thing that makes it even worse is because this book is set in the past, like way past, like 90s, if not before then, if I'm not mistaken. So you know that the camera is not even the one that you click. You probably have to pump it like this machine that do some that used to check your heart block, your blood pressure. And this man is there in the middle of strife and commotion, talking about smile, please. And then the audacity of him to bring the pictures to you. In the beginning, when they were fighting in the house during the meeting, compound meeting, this man came and took unsolicited pictures that nobody asked him to take. And then he had the audacity to come back and be like, okay, so you are paying for these pictures. Excuse me, sir. What do you mean? He was just snapping everything he wishes and then you have to pay for it. He's there documentary their lives and you have to pay for it because, you know, my favorite episode, however, was the Day of the Politician's Meal. That was the last episode that I read before I stopped reading this book. That episode was hilarious. Apart from the fact that it speaks truly, you know, about the whole idea of like your idea of politics and how like all the, you know, these parties and the rich people and whatnot, they come to rural areas to try to buy your votes. That legit be happening. And they came with bad milk. The least you could have done, my nigga, the least you could have done is to at least come up correct. They gave me bad milk and shared the milk and everybody went home to eat and then it turned into something. And then they didn't eat it because of sheer, let's say, ego or something. Just for this man, just for a flying insect to come out of the milk. And this man, as I was dad, talking about, oh, that is looking like my relative. He's here. And my favorite part, again, there are different parts that made me laugh while reading this book. There's some parts that I have to pause and laugh. God, I wish I can make like a bloopers episode where I just like attach different bloopers of myself reading this book. I had to laugh. Yo, there's one time I couldn't. I was laughing. Like, it took me like 30 minutes to get my life together to then come back and finish reading it. It was hilarious to me. And I believe that was the episode. That was the chapter where the father started fighting and threw his TV. Through somebody's TV, I mean like his TV, I can't remember. That was so hilarious. I couldn't stop laughing. I feel like there are parts of this book that just make me laugh. And I know that you can tell when I'm laughing because even though I'm reading, you probably can hear my smile and my laugh. That's one thing I love about reading books. And why another reason why I'm coming back to finish this book is because I just, in my mind, I'm just thinking, okay, see, sister, so what is going to happen? You're just going to quit? You're really just going to quit reading this book that you came to the internet to come and talk about how you must read it? You really want to embarrass your family like that? So yeah, I'm going to finish this book by fire or by force. And then, because also I want to start reading other books, this particular book that I'm about to dive into, I want to read, and I feel like it's very nice. It's a very nice read. So I might alternate, because I know that not everybody cares for this Famish Road. So if I post an episode of me reading Famish Road this week,
or we may do next week reading another book, or better still, we can do 3 times a week. So on Monday, which is usually the normal podcast episode Monday, then Wednesday we can have this particular book, and then Saturday we can do Famish Road. I don't know how it work. People probably just hear from me when you hear from me, and you already know how it works here. But I want to read A Broken People's Playlist. I feel like it's the best transition into books for people who don't necessarily like to read. Why? It's because it's a compilation of short stories, and it's a book by Chimamanda Garrix. I like this book. I read this book in around my birthday time, like August-ish of 2022, I believe. And it was so, like, I don't want to say so sad, but it's exactly what it is, A Broken People's Playlist. And honestly speaking, the book, I have a lot of reservations about the book, and I'm going to talk about them. She's also the author of Tomorrow Died Yesterday. I haven't read that, but this particular book on People's Playlist, I think I have something to say in every chapter that we read. And it's going to be a quick read as well, because I'm going to try to read each story per book club episode. And then we'll talk about it at the end of the book club. I don't know how many pages it kind of is, but let me quickly do a quick dive. So, and I like the fact that it has songs. Yo, I'm into this. There's a track list, because the books allegedly are from songs. So the first one is Lost Stars by Adam Levine. So we can do that. We can make this work. I'll read this this first chapter, and then we listen to the music, and then after we come and talk about it. The music, just looking at the music, I feel like the tracks are really nice. Lost Stars track, let me go through the track list with you guys. Number one, Lost Stars by Adam Levine. Number two, Music, Eric Sermon and Marvin Gaye. Number three, Heart by Johnny Cash. Songs, Song for Someone, U2. In the City, Brymo. I Put a Spell on You, Nina Simone. I Die With You, PM, Dawn. Beautiful War, Kings of Leon. River, Leon Bridges. Love's Divine Seal, Desperado, Eagles. You Supposed to Know, Benz, featuring Yemi Alade. Yeah. And so it starts by, for example, now chapter one, the name is Lost Stars, written under the influence of Lost Stars by Adam Levine. And 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37. This is a long chapter. I don't think we can be able to. This is like 45 pages per chapter, and I'm sure it varies. It can't exactly be exactly to 45 through each chapter. So we might do 2 chapters a week, just because I can just, as I was counting, I'm just imagining me talking for hours, and I really don't. I feel like a misconception about podcasters is that we love to talk. Now, I don't know that it's old age or just me evolving into this woman, but I don't really want to be talking for long. So I guess we'll see how it goes. I don't know. It depends on my mood when I start reading. So we'll see if I can hack the chapter per episode. But ideally now, let me just be honest and upfront with you guys. We might do half a chapter an episode, or a good length. An episode and stop there, and then the last episode of that chapter we can talk about the actual book, you know. So that's what I really want to do. I want to do this. I feel like A Broken People's Playlist was such a good read for me at the time when I read it. In addition to that, I feel like it's a really good, like I said earlier, it's a really good transition for people who don't necessarily like to read or read a lot of books, because it's broken down in different chapters, there's different storylines, different like writing styles, different characters, different like problems in each character. So you won't get bored, is what I'm trying to say. If you read one and it's good for you, okay. And then if you don't like it, you can go to the next one. And I feel like the length is good enough that you don't get bored too soon, rather than reading 1,884 pages of Ben Okri's like longest writing. no offense to Ben O'Quinn, because he did a phenomenal job. He did a phenomenal job on this book. And just for me to find out that this Ben O'Quinn's Famish Road is not the only one, there's a continuation called Sons of Enchantment.
That's the part two. And I don't know why Azari's taking us to the part two, really. You didn't learn your lesson in the first one. But yeah, and oh yeah, another favorite character of mine from this Famish Road is Azari's dad. I feel like I need to do a chapter where I talk about different characters and why I like them. Azara's dad symbolizes a head of a family, in the essence that he really sacrifices for his family. He tries the best that he can and he stays true to them. This man went to be carrying cement and everything because he had to feed his family. He's not an irresponsible somebody. That's why I appreciate him as a character. He wakes up in the morning and he goes to work, whatever the work is, he goes in search of something. And even though I can totally tell his frustration because he's probably not getting what he wants, it's like he doesn't have like those qualifications or whatnot, so what he can do is literally limited. But he gives this character that tries his best to provide for his family and he's doing whatever he can. And let's not forget, he still like undoubtedly loves his wife, and even Azaro, like he loves him so much, even though Azaro gives him so much stress. And Azaro's mom is a meek character. I feel like she has strength in her. She's this kind of woman that you don't want to push, because they can literally be like Camille's mom and just kill you, you know. So that's if you don't know what I mean by Campbell's mom, that's Purple Hibiscus by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. But yeah, I feel like she's a very meek character. She's a typical Nigerian woman, traditional woman, who's quiet and just resigns whatever her fate is to her husband to do. Luckily for her, she has a husband that tries. Because if that woman jam somebody that does not do anything, that's just... So yeah, but she's resilient, she loves her son. She's the typical Nigerian, like, African traditional woman, I guess. Nothing so special about that, so far as I've read. Azaro is a troubled kid. He's a troubled kid, that boy. And I feel like all of his problems could have been solved if he had like a family where he could come out and tell them, oh, I see spirits and this and that. He's just a troubled kid, and I don't want to go to Azaro yet, because I feel like I can feel he's evolving very soon in the books. So I'm just going to let that continue. And then today's episode is, first of all, I'm going to end this introduction here because it's going too long. So yeah, welcome, and let me not waste much time. Without further ado, let's dive into episode 6-3. Yeah, that's what we're gonna call it, 6-3. And this episode, based on how I read it, we're going to call it The Journey into the Unseen, because this boy is supposed to survive those chains. For what? He just went to cause commotion. But yeah, let's go. Let's get into it.
Seven. The next time I went to Madame Koto's bar, the place was full of big blue flies. The smell of the animal's skin and sweat and fresh turned earth assailed me. It was hot and stuffy, crowded with total strangers. All of them looked as freakish as the people who were there the last time. The difference was that there had been a grotesque interchange among the clientele. There was an albino boy. He was tall and had a head like a tuber of yam. The man who was blue was in one eye, was white and blank like a polished moonstone in the other. The two men who were sinister in dark glasses now had white hair and curious hip deformations. The youth who had no teeth was now a woman. I recognized them all beneath their transformed appearances. There were others I hadn't seen before. One of them looked like a lizard with small, fixed green eyes. And amongst these strange people, there were others who seemed normal, who had stopped off on their way home from their jobs for an evening drink. The place was so crowded that I had to struggle through the tight, jammed bodies, all of them rockers, all of them singing, passing abuses and bad jokes across the bar. I heard voices that were unearthly, languages that were nasal and alien, laughter that could only have come from dead tree trunks at night or from hollow graves. began to feel ill again, just pushing my way through their bodies, which smelled bloodless and looked pale. The mutant customers made the bar feel entirely different. They conferred on everything a dull yellow light. The bar itself gave the impression that it had been transported from its familiar environs of our area to somewhere under the road, under the sea, to a dimly remembered and unwanted landscape. Their laughter made the light lurid. Their merged voices made me twitch, and the toothless woman breaking suddenly into a high-pitched squeal of pleasure unleashed on me a surprising rush of fear. I managed to make my way to my position near the Ethanware port. All the seats were taken and two midgets shared a stool, drinking serenely. I did not recognize either of them, but they both smiled at me. The toothless woman turned towards me, staring hard, and then very slowly pulled out something from beneath the table. I watched, fascinated by her magician's gesture. When she had pulled it out completely, I saw that it was a sack. I screamed and tried to get out of the door, but every available space was packed. The crowd jostled me, blocking my way as though they were deliberately trying to prevent my escape. While not seeming to do so, I shouted and a deep-throated laughter drowned my voice. I pushed, and the harder I tried, the more completely I was surrounded. Then I realized that more people were pouring in from the doorway, materializing, it seemed, from the night air. The clientele kept multiplying, filling out the spaces. They stood over me, giant figures with hair that fell off in clumps on my face. The multiplication frightened me. The woman with no teeth became two, the midgets became four, the two men with dark glasses and white hair became three. The man with a bulbous eye acquired a double, and the double had a bulbous eye on the other side of his face. I calmed down. I had no weapon against their multiplication. The noise lowered. Everything quivered. I moved slowly, as if underwater, towards the edge of a bench. I sat down. The people who surrounded me kept glancing in my direction every now and again, as if discreetly trying to make sure I was still in the bar. I became aware of being watched by everyone, even when they were not looking at me. I became convinced that they all had hidden and invisible eyes at the sides and back of their heads, and it was only when I looked up at one of the men who was so tall his head seemed to touch the cobweb-infested rafters that I knew the purity of fear. The man had a white mouth, prominent nostrils that flared unnaturally when he breathed, and two big disproportionate ears, and to my horror he had no eyes. I screamed very loudly and I kicked the man's shin and he leant over to me and opened his wide mouth as if he were going to swallow me. Then he stayed like that in apparent contemplation. I found myself staring into the horror of his mouth. It was very dark and ugly, and at the back of his mouth there was a single luminous disc like a flattened moonstone, and I was horrified to see the disc blinking. Then I realized I was staring at an eye. I drew back in my shock, and the eye elongated towards me and then moved around like a bright marble stuck in his throat. I spat at the eye and struggled away from him, kicking and raving. The man made a common sound and leant over again, his mouth open, and he looked for me, but I had made it across the room. I felt a moment's relief, but when I saw the people surrounding me, I struggled to escape again. Some of them were tall, eyeless women, and next to me sat three men in dark glasses. All three of them turned their heads in my direction. One of them took off his glasses, and instead of blank white eyes I had expected, he had normal ones. "What's wrong with you?" he asked. "Nothing. Why did you spit into that man's mouth?" "The boy is insane," said another of the three. "Unbalanced," said the first. "Drunk," said the second. "Hold him," said the third. "Yes, grab him before he spits at us." I edged away, keeping an eye on them. As I watched them, they began to transform, breaking out of their molds. Their shoulders seemed momentarily hunched back. Their eyes blazed through their glasses, and their teeth resembled fangs. I edged away slowly and found another corner and stared intently at everyone. The clientele kept changing, becoming something other. What they were underneath kept emerging under the fleeting transparency of their skins. After a while, I thought my eyes were playing elaborate tricks on me, or that my fever was evading me in strange ways, and I shut my eyes. When I opened them, the tall woman with no eyes had disappeared. I ran out of the bar and took the long way around the back. Madame Couture was sitting on a stool holding her head. Occasionally, she made a vomiting sound and groaned. She didn't have her white beads. She looked like a compressed rhinoceros, understood. I touched her and she startled. "Oh, it's you," she said. Her face was sunken. She looked quite ill. "What happened to you?" She gave me a sour look, made a desperate vomiting motion, held her stomach and said, "It was the milk. You drank it?" Of course, she backed. We didn't. She said nothing. She fell into another futile spasm of vomiting. She looked dreadful. What about the people in the bar? What about them? They were the ones who carried me away. When? The last time I was here. Nonsense. True. Where did they carry you to? To the river. Which river? I don't know. But they were witches and wizards. How do you know? Are you one yourself? Look at them. They are just troublemakers. They have finished all my pepper soup and I'm not well enough to deal with them. What shall I do? I don't know. Do what you like, or leave me alone or I'll vomit on you. She sounded so malicious in her bad temper that I believed she would actually vomit on me. I went back to the bar and stayed at the door. I listened to the sound, the loud, sonorous voices, and I watched them as they laughed and banged the tables. And then I made an instant discovery. I realized for the first time that many of the customers were not human beings. Their deformations were too staggering and they seemed unaffected by their blindness and their eyelessness. Their hunchbacked and toothless mouths, their expression and movement were at odds with their bodies. They seemed a confused assortment of different human parts. It occurred to me that they were spirits who had borrowed bits of human beings to partake of human reality. They say spirits do that sometimes. They do it because they get tired of being just spirits. They want to taste human beings. They want to taste human things. Pain, drunkenness, laughter, and sex. Sometimes they do it to spread mischief and sometimes to seduce grown-ups or abduct children into their realm. The moment I saw them as spirits drinking palm wine without getting drunk, confused about the natural configuration of the human body, everything made sense. And then I became certain that Madame Coteau's fetish has somehow been attracting them. I was confirmed in this notion by the fact that they seemed to cluster most thickly beneath the fetish. I knew what I had to do. I went outside and said to Madame Coteau, "Your bar is full of spirits." "Leave me alone," she shouted. I left her alone and went round to the front and searched for a branch that was forked at the end. I went down the widening parts and found sticks, but they were either not too long enough or strong enough. I got to the edge of the forest and heard trees groaning as they crashed down on their neighbors. I listened to trees being felled deep in the forest and heard the steady rhythms of axes on hard living wood. The silence magnified the rhythms. I found a branch which seemed perfect. I broke off the long wood of the forked ends, lacerated myself on the splinters, and bled. I took the stick bar with me to the bar. At the backyard, Madame Coteau was still on the stool, looking like a rhinoceros whose horn had been cut off. She held her head and uttered a low wailing sound. I went into the bar through the front door. The disguised spirits were now completely uproarious. They had overrun the place in an orgy of merriment, jumping up and down, dancing to non-existent melodies, fighting, singing unfamiliar songs in harsh languages. The man with the bubbles eye was playing with his other detachable one. A man who had removed his arm from its socket was hitting the toothless woman on the head with it. The spirits were drunk with the debauched humanity and frolicked in the grotesque merriment. I climbed on the branch and prodded the fetish with the stick. I had lifted it off the nail and was bringing it down when one of the spirits saw me from the other end of the bar and gave a piercing cry. I got down hastily. The fetish fell from the stick. There was a terrible silence in the bar, and then the disguised spirit who had shouted pointed at me and in a voice of command cried, "Seize that boy!" I snatched the fetish from the floor, feeling its potencies burning into my palm, and fought madly past the borrowed legs of the spirits and gained the doorway. I stumbled and fell at the bar front. For a moment, I couldn't find the fetish. I searched around furiously while the commotion in the bar spilled outside. I eventually found the fetish under the bushes where it seemed to have crawled like a crab. I caught it just as Madame Couture responded to the clamor. She saw me and shouted, "Azaro, are you mad? Bring that thing back!" In a heavy milk contorted gait, she bounded after me. She wasn't the only one. The spirits were after me as well, and one of them held his detachable arm in the air like a misgotten club. I fled down the path. Their heavy footsteps sounded behind me and they shouted my name. "Azaro, Azaro!" The whole area rang with my name. So fearfully did the spirits call it out that the lights changed and yellow clouds materialized beside me. It seemed I had entered another realm. Like animals who had discovered speech, they screamed my name, each in a different voice. I ran behind huts, hid behind sand heaps, but they were able to smell me out. The dogs barked my name, odd-looking goats blocked my path, and chickens flew out of the bushes in front of me. The trees rebounded the vowels of my name, and I felt everything was in conspiracy with the spirits to betray my hiding places. Nothing seemed safe for me, not the rotted foundations of houses where I was set upon by strange insects, nor the circular well in which I considered hiding, but from which my name echoed, nor the anthill behind which red soldier ants deployed their magnificent forces. So I made for the forest. I passed Madame Couture's sacrificed wood. The place was intact, but food and ritual objects had gone. I went and lay down behind the great fallen tree where I had seen the two-legged dog. But I feared I might roll over into the pit and, unable to get out, become part of the road. So I ran deeper into the forest. The spirits were all over the place. They gave every tree a voice. I saw a rusted machete on the ground and picked it up. The man with the bloated eye pounced on me and I smashed his arm with the machete and he did not utter a sound, nor did he bleed. I dug the fetish into his bad eye and he let me go, blinded by Madame Couture's powers. I ran on till I got lost. I was not sure anymore where I was running. I stopped. I wandered among the silent, listening trees. I no longer heard the footsteps of the spirits, but from afar I could see hear them calling my name. The voices were feeble on the wind. It was rapidly getting dark. The wind blew hard through the trees. Trees groaned, branches cracked, and the wind among the leaves sounded like a distant waterfall. Pods exploded from on high, and one of them fell on my head like a mighty knock, and I dropped to the ground. In the silence and darkness that came over me, I found myself riding the invisible horse of the night. I rode through the trees. All around me were silent figures in great masks. All around me were ancestral statues. Whatever I rode, I saw immemorial monoliths with solemn faces and beaded lapis lazuli eyes. The monoliths were of gold, self-illuminating in the darkness. One of the statues moved and turned into Madame Couture. Her golden wrapper fluttering about her, she climbed onto a caparisoned horse of the night and commanded the other statues and monoliths to follow her. The figures in great masks moved. The statues moved. They climbed their horses and rode after me. I rode furiously and arrived at a place where all the winds of the world converged. The winds blew the army of statues one by one off their horses and they broke into golden fragments. Only Madame Couture, an implacable warrior, stayed on her horse and thundered after me. Just before she fell on me, it began to rain. The water pouring down gradually effaced her, beginning with her raised arm and her grim sword. Her arm dissolved into an indigo liquid and poured down her face, and her face dissolved slowly as if the rain were an acid that ate away flesh and steel. Then her hair fell off and her head became reduced, and then her head rolled off into a ball of red waters and her shoulder melted, and eventually her great massive bulk disappeared, and all that remained were two big fierce eyes which throbbed on the ground and stared at me. And then the horse neighed and lifted his front hoofs in the air and turned and galloped away, busting her two eyes with its hind feet. Then it too disappeared amid infernal sounds into the effulgent winds. I found myself wandering under the downpour. The fetish was still in my hand. I wandered in the restless rain till I found the clearing. I was weary. The fetish seemed to have grown heavier and its laden weight frightened me. I threw the fetish into the middle of the clearing away from any trees. Then I decided to bury it just in case the spirits of Madame Couture accidentally found it. I dug a hole with a stick. Water filled the hole. I didn't mind. I stuck the fetish into the hole and covered it with wet earth. And then I struck branches and sticks around the hole to remind me where I had buried the fetish. Then I made my way back to the edge of the forest and stayed under the eaves of a hut till the rain softened. I was cold, my teeth rattled. The hand with which I had held the fetish was dyed indigo. The skin of the palm peeled away in wet flakes as though the fetish had eaten my flesh. The rain softened, drizzling, and I made my way home cautiously. Dogs howled in the dark. The wind blew strongly and lifted off the roof of bungalow and knocked it over the adjoining compound. The tenants wailed in the horrible voices of those who have been judged and damned, as if God had ripped off the cover of their lives and exposed them to a merciless infinity. They screamed in terrible desolation like Adam and Eve being sent out of the Garden of Eden forever. There was a sad night with the children crying and the rain pouring over their possessions. There was nothing I could do to help, and I went on home, listening to thunder rumbling from its distant homestead and lightning cracking its multiple candid figures over the great trees. Everything held menace for me. The barking of dogs was like the gnashing of vengeful spirits. Branches cracking sounded as if they were about to spring on me, and even the clothes and garments flapping on washing lines seemed so like Madame Couture, dissolved from the world of flesh, threatening to wreak eternal havoc on me for the loss of her fetish. I went a long and complicated route to avoid going past her bar front. And when I got home, Dad was on his three-legged chair smoking a cigarette. The mosquito coil was on the table. The broken window had been mended, and fresh sweet cooking warmed the room with its aroma. Mom came in with a tray of food and said, "You're just in time." Dad looked at me, laughed, and said, "So the rain beat you?" I nodded, shivering. "Dry yourself," Mom said. I went and had a quick wash and dried myself with Dad's towel. I came back in and sat on the half-spread mat. I ate with Mom and Dad from the same bowls. The candlelight illuminated our faces. After I ate, I curled up on the mat, planting my secret in my silence, and slept as if nothing unusual had happened.